This is Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, where we discuss developments currently shaping markets, industries, and the global economy. I'm Jake Seward, Global Head of Corporate Communications here at the firm. Today, we're coming to you from California, where we're hosting the 2018 Builders and Innovators Summit. This is an event where Goldman brings together 100 or so of the most intriguing entrepreneurs we know. So it's fitting that for today's episode, we're talking about startup life with two co-founders of two very different companies. Jen Rubio is the co-founder and chief brand officer of Away, which is trying and succeeding at disrupting the luggage industry. And we also have Josh Hoffman, co-founder and CEO of Zymergen, a biotech startup. We're also happy to be joined by Dan Dees, who is co-head of Goldman's investment banking division. And he has extensive experience dealing with startups as a banker. Dan, Jen, Josh, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Great. So, Dan, let's talk a little bit about the innovation economy. We hear a lot about that buzzword. What does that mean to you, and how do you think about it in the context of this summit that we're hosting today?
To me, the innovation economy is the concept that innovation and advances in technology are driving economic growth and progress, and that the alternative of incrementalism, of just doing the same thing you've done in the past and doing it slightly better over time, is increasingly being pressured by innovation and by the forces of disruption. It's nothing new. It's been this way for probably decades beyond my experience. But what has changed recently and what I think is really interesting is it feels like it is accelerating. This innovative pressure is intensifying. It's broadening beyond just technology businesses. And so here we sit with the consumer business and the healthcare business, where innovative pressures are creating opportunities. And it feels like we are in a world now where the consequences are greater. So the benefits and rewards of being on the right side of the innovation wave are greater, and the penalties of missing an innovation cycle are more dire. The way you see it evidenced at this summit is everywhere. Every one of these entrepreneurs that we have brought to this summit are here because they're innovators, whether it's the product and service that they do that they're innovating, or whether it's the way they go to market or the way they run their business. They are at heart innovators, and that's what's led to their success.
You mentioned this, but the lines between technology and the rest of the economy are really blurry these days, and technology is creeping into every business. And if you're not on top of the latest technology, you can easily get blown up. What does that mean for the more established players in different industries and for the startups?
The ability to tell the difference between what is a tech company and what is a different company is increasingly hard to do. Everyone is essentially a tech company these days in some way, shape, or form. Or to put it differently, if technology isn't a basic part of the fabric of your business, then you are certainly the exception in today's world. And so I think that there is a blurring line. What it means for the startups, this age of technology and innovation, is incredibly exciting because I think you can build technology solutions that allow you to get to market faster, address enormous markets quickly, effectively, and really, in many ways, compete with very large incumbents in a way that's cheaper than it ever has been and faster to market than it ever has been. So I think it's incredibly exciting for startups. For the legacy businesses or traditional businesses or whatever term you'd want to use for that, it's obviously a scary time in some instances because your businesses are getting disrupted. But what we see is many of our clients just embracing technology, using technology in new ways to drive the growth of their businesses. And the reality is that the winner is going to be somewhere in the middle, and it will be very case dependent on which industry and which company. And in some ways, you've seen a lot of the technology companies recently that were celebrated for the fact that they didn't have the physical infrastructure and they had this beautiful kind of lightweight model enabled by technology, now coming back towards the legacy or traditional companies and buying physical infrastructure, or digital media companies hiring editors and curators. You see a meeting in the middle somewhere. And so it's an exciting time both for traditional legacy companies and for the startups.
Josh, you mentioned that your company's awfully hard to describe, but give it a shot. Tell us what your elevator pitch is for your company.
Zymergen is a molecular technology company. We integrate advanced molecular biology, machine learning, and automation to program microbes, little single-cell creatures, to make novel chemicals and materials, hopefully creating a materials revolution analogous to the materials revolution beginning of the petrochemical industry at the turn of the 19th and through the first half of the 20th century. To give you a practical example, lots of people have talked about flexible OLED displays for phones, but they also enable wearable electronics. They really can change the form factor of modern electronics as we understand them. But they've been talked about for a while, and you see demos at CES, but they haven't hit the market. And the reason they haven't hit the market is that the materials that are used for what's called the cover panel, the composite layers of materials that are the screen, they don't work. Now, when you use biology, you get to start from a foundationally different set of starting points. We're working with a tier one supplier. that after 6 months of development is already better than the best-in-class product, and we expect to be in the tech stack sometime in the next couple years. And what we're doing is using these really incredibly advanced technologies, modern genomics and molecular biology, machine learning, automation, to create transformative physical materials that then open up tons of other kinds of opportunities. And we're doing that across healthcare, consumer goods, electronics, marine, agriculture, et cetera.
Cool. So Jen, your turn, a little bit simpler maybe, but give me your pitch on Away and what your mission is.
Yeah, we make luggage. And that's it.
And so, hopefully.
Our core business is making luggage. We're a direct-to-consumer company, so we make and sell very thoughtfully designed luggage for about a third of the price of what it would normally cost retail. So high-end luggage, lower price point. But over the last few years, what we've been able to do as we've built our community and built our brand is really think about how we're innovating on the design and experience as it relates to travel. We launched a little over 2.5 years ago, which has been very exciting, and built this community that has basically been demanding more and more from us. So we've launched a media division as part of our business, a little bit crazy in this age, launching a print magazine, but that's been really successful for us so far. We've also been dabbling in hospitality. So we've done a few pop-up hotels, some experiences, and really just thinking about how to make travel more seamless and more enjoyable.
So you were at Warby Parker, which obviously had a similar mission in a different industry. How did that experience shape your idea to start this company?
Well, it's actually funny. I have a co-founder, Steph Corey. She's our CEO. We met while at Warby Parker. So I was running social media, doing marketing there, and she was running supply chain. And when my suitcase broke and I was looking for a replacement and couldn't find a suitable alternative, I was going at it with the mindset of brand, brand, brand. Like, there's a brand play here. No luggage companies are talking about travel. They're talking about ballistic nylon and wheels and zippers and not the things that people actually care about or want to talk about. So I was coming at it through the lens of how can we create a brand that people love and use that as a platform to launch new things. And as soon as I brought the idea to Steph, she was like, there's a supply chain disruption here. There are layers and layers of markups, wholesale, licensing, retail, and we can go straight to the factory, we can create our own product and sell something incredible for a much more affordable price. And those were both things, the brand and the supply chain disruption that we had experience in at Warby Parker. So we kind of took the same experience at the same company for the same amount of time and applied that to what we're doing today.
Did you think you were going to be entrepreneurs, or how did you find your way into starting a business?
I grew up from one of those immigrant families that was like, you can be a doctor or a lawyer. Lawyer was only an option because I was bad at science.
Those aren't terribly entrepreneurial professions.
So I didn't even know being an entrepreneur was a thing that you could do. And I never saw myself as a founder or someone who's going to start a company. I was very excited by startups kind of a few years into my career and started looking into that world, but still never saw myself as a founder. And I think because the idea came from a personal pain point, the more we dug into it, the more we realized, like, hey, there's really no one better to do this.
And you had a bit of a finance background, consulting. I mean, how did you find your way into this?
So I'm an accidental entrepreneur. I came to it very late. I was in my mid-40s before I started. I'd been a consultant for a long time, and I worked at a couple banks, including being on the management committee of a mid-sized investment bank. And I'd set up a sort of investing and advising shop with a partner. And then two things happened. He passed away tragically. And one of the last things we looked at was a biofuels company. And as I got to understand some of what they were doing, we realized that you could upend the scientific method, right? Instead of starting with a hypothesis, biology is so complicated, you want to start with a search. And that simple flipping of the problem, instead of saying, I'm a scientist who's going to begin with a hypothesis and then test it, say, I'm going to be hypothesis free, and I'm going to use the robots to generate the data to run that machine learning algorithm. In one sense, it's kind of simple and elegant. On the other, there's an enormous tech stack that has to go there.
Neither one of you aspired necessarily to be an entrepreneur. And we often hear the glamour stories about entrepreneurs, people who grew up wanting to build businesses. Talk a little bit about the flip side, the difficulties of being an entrepreneur, because that gets a little less attention. You want to start, Jen?
Yeah, I mean, I talk about this all the time, so much so that I was on another podcast a couple of weeks ago, and they were like, could you make this a little more positive and uplifting? But I think that, I mean, I think social media has a big part of it, and it's not just, you know, entrepreneurship or being a founder, but We're in a world where people post the highlights of their life. Nobody wants to see social media posts of like you late night at your desk eating like Chinese food for the 10th week in a row or going to a pitch and not having it work out. Like nobody posts about that. You know, for every single article out there about someone raising millions and millions of dollars, there were a lot of no's and a lot of rejection. And no one really talks about the hard things. Except me, like come find me after this, the wine thing. It's the whole myth of the founder. It's like it's very glamorous as it's portrayed right now. And I think it's creating this new breed of founders who are dead set on being a founder. And they don't know what they want to start. And they don't know what being a founder really means. But they know they want to be a founder. And it's not like kids. It's like people at like very good business schools. Every time I teach a course or give a talk at an Ivy League business school, I have people come up to me saying, so I'm going to be a founder. And I'm like, what's the idea? And they're like, oh, I don't know yet, but that's great, right? And I think it's just easier than ever to start a business. There's a lot of tools out there, a lot of great platforms, a lot of capital. But I think that all of this media and all of the buzz around being a founder is really contributing to a really weird sense of what it's actually like.
How about you? You worked in more traditional jobs.
Yeah.
And this is obviously a leap into the unknown for you.
This is both the hardest and the best job I've ever had. And those two things, in fact, the one causes the other. I care more about this than anything I've ever done. With no disrespect to consulting firm I was at, an investment bank, places that I valued where I have great colleagues, people who've invested in this company, amazing places that forged who I am, where I learned a ton. I worked with great clients. I invested in great companies. But they weren't mine in the same way. And this is mine, you know, along with a couple other people. And so there's an emotional commitment. What that means is that the barriers between what you're prepared to give are lower, right? There is no stopping. The commitment is bottomless in a way that I've never had before. And that's great, super rewarding, but can be hard. And so when things are hard, and I don't mean the everyday hard, you know, one of the nice things about starting a business in your mid-40s is you know they're going to be bad days and you can kind of just ride them out. But when you have bad months or bad quarters or bad 6 months, you start to feel it in a way that you don't before. And so it just requires a level of emotional resilience and balance that is super hard and not the easiest thing to do.
You mentioned resilience, scrappiness. What are the other traits that are really critical to help you build the business that you've built?
Just to build more on what I was saying and what you were saying, it is that passion. That's what gets you through the hard day, weeks, months, whatever it is. If you just looked at the landscape of a certain industry and decided, sure, there's a gap there, I'm going to build a company there, that's not what's going to get you through the tough times. I think, like you said, it is that emotional attachment to what you're building that's really important.
Yes, what she said. I think you have to have a commitment to the thing you're building that is simultaneously absolutely about the commercial reality, like you got to make money, and at the same time can't be about some glamorous exit. It's not about an IPO. It's not about making money. You have to have a commitment to that idea because the tough times can be hard.
From my end of things, if we weren't really passionate about it and really committed, I'd just be a luggage salesperson.
Yeah.
So Dan, you work with a lot of companies that have gotten through the stage and eventually, you know, IPO'd or been bought. What traits do you consistently see across that set of founders?
Well, Jen and Joshua just hit on a bunch of them. The traits that they talk about that define their approach are the traits I see in the successful people who make it through. The one trait, and you just got at this, Joshua, the one trait that you don't see, or the one indicator that tends to be negatively correlated, is people who are building businesses with the IPO as an end game, or I'm building it to sell it to Amazon, or I'm building it to sell it to Microsoft. Those tend to be the ones that don't have legs and don't make it past in an interesting way. But the traits that I do see, again, that are reminiscent from what I just heard, are the founder has to have a vision for what their market fit is, what problem they're trying to solve, what their edge is, and they always do. They have to have an ability to sell that vision to others, both in raising money, but more importantly, in building a team of people who want to follow them and build the business. I've met a lot of people with great ideas that never were able to build the institution around it that helped them take it forward. They've got to have this interesting mix between stubbornness and adaptability. And, you know, they have to adapt because the market changes on you and you have to adapt, but they always take longer to adapt than I would have pushed them to do, but they tend to be right. They stick with their conviction for longer and it's to their betterment. And I think it's really an impressive trait that they have the courage of their convictions, and when they have to, they'll change, but they stick with the courage and their convictions as long as they can. And then the passion and the ability to ride out the tough times, no question. The one that I'd mention that may be counterintuitive in today's day and age is the great ones that I have met and worked with have a view on profitability and how they're going to get there. And that doesn't mean they're not going to forego it for a very long period of time and deliberately forego it for a long period of time, but they have a view on the unit economics, they have a view on how they'll ultimately make a business out of this passion, out of this approach that they're taking. And that's always in their minds. They always know where they're heading ultimately from a business model perspective. Those are some of the commentaries.
We talked a little bit about entrepreneurs, talked a little bit about teams. How about communities, Dan? You've worked in the Valley a lot. You worked in Asia, very vibrant economies in both areas. How would you contrast a little bit, like what are the traits that bring innovation out and what are the differences that you see between some of the innovation we're seeing coming out of Asia, particularly China, and what you're seeing coming out of the Valley?
It's changing a lot. The whole comparison of those two landscapes, I would narrow your question in from Asia to China compared to Silicon Valley. I worked over there for 10 years, and I would say back in the day, for lack of anything more specific, but back in the day, there was a notion that innovation happened in Silicon Valley and imitation happened in China, and that China was taking U.S. business models, tweaking them a little bit to local market practice, and that was what was happening. And maybe there was an element of truth in that. That has changed dramatically over the last many years, and it's been extraordinary to watch. And the innovation, the true forward-thinking innovation that's happening and coming out of China right now is pretty extraordinary. And I think what's leading to it is, you know, the demographics. You got 1.5 billion people, and hundreds of millions of them are on mobile phones. They live their life on a mobile phone. They're comfortable with their wallet on a mobile phone. They have chat networks that connect literally hundreds of millions and that can serve as a platform for other products. And you have the wealth creation that's happened by some of the biggest companies in history rising up over there, Alibaba and Tencent and others, and the trickle-down of that wealth seeding that next generation of companies. And so you have all that money flowing in. You have that enormous market. There's a bit of a protected market in China, in some cases from other competition. And it's an incredibly fertile ground for innovation. You know, if you ask me, where's the next great innovation? It's a much more even race than it used to be. And on the consumer side, I could see the next wave of great innovations happening in China. On the enterprise side, I still think it's more of a U.S. game.
Can I ask a question about that? Because I have a hypothesis, which based on your experience, you may tell me is nuts. In the real economy, not just the enterprise side, but all the stuff that touches the physical economy. In China, you've got a whole bunch of people who are really talented entrepreneurs in a whole bunch of adjacent technologies. And so my hypothesis is that the technology-driven disruptions in the real economy are much likelier to come from China than they are from any part of the West, because the folks who are involved and engaged in those businesses in the West are just less entrepreneurial by and large. Now, is that a nutty hypothesis, or does that make sense?
It makes sense. I don't think it's a nutty hypothesis. I get at maybe the same answer a slightly different way. And one of the ways I get at it is what you have in a lot of places in China is less of the traditional infrastructure to business and to business practices and to getting things done. Mm-hmm. And as a result, digital approaches and technology-enabled approaches can kind of leapfrog traditional industries.
Jane, you talked a little bit before about how easy it is to get capital, how abundant capital is, maybe not how easy it is. How did you decide how much money to raise and how did you go about doing it?
We were pretty conservative in our fundraising, or so we think. So we've raised a little over $80 million. I would say the seed round, that first $2.5 million, was probably the hardest. It was just two girls selling luggage.
Did you have any luggage to sell yet? Or
no, it was two girls selling a picture of luggage. But I think once we launched and there was momentum and there were real numbers behind what we were doing and a much broader vision that we were pitching, it got easier and easier, especially when there are bigger comps. So people want to talk about us as the Warby Parker for luggage. There are companies like Casper who are very similar that are doing it for mattresses. When investors start to see that, it is easier to get capital and it's easier to compare numbers and to compare traction and things like that. It's always really been that fundraising is not the goal. It's what we do to fund our goals and to drive the business forward. You know, it's not like a big party when we close a round. It's like, okay, now we get to work. And to your point about profitability earlier, I think we've always just weirdly been laser focused on that. So you talk about community, and we have been a little bit removed from the Silicon Valley community. So we're backed by VC firms in San Francisco, but we are building the company in New York. We don't consider ourselves tech people by any means. Tech enables our business, but we're more in fashion and media and culture, and those are kind of the things that we're doing to build that business. So with that in mind, I think we never had the growth at all costs mindset. We reached profitability last year. It was our second year in business, and it's something that, you know, we want to keep being profitable, but are also really mindful of how we're growing. So we took a different approach than some other venture-backed businesses, especially ones that are creating a hard product. I think we've been really satisfied with the way we've raised money so far.
So Josh, coming to it as a former banker who, you know, knew the lingo, how did you go about thinking about how to structure your fundraising and to go about it?
Let's be clear. My experience at the much larger, more established end was somewhere between unhelpful, or sort of not helpful, and actively unhelpful. Early stage investing is as much about conforming to a set of pre-existing norms and codes, and do you have the right language? I didn't know them because that wasn't the world I'd come from. And what we did didn't have the comps. I mean, your point about when you can be the Casper for luggage or the Warby Parker, like what we do is hard and technical and it's never been done before, which is what makes it exciting and amazing, but also makes
it a little harder to bet on.
Well, it's super hard to explain. There are a ton of early stage investors who are pattern spotters. They're looking for a thing. The worst version of it is they're looking, you know, the kind of skinny white male college Harvard dropout, right, who's doing a consumer tech play, right? There was nothing about what we did that fit that pattern. And so it was quite hard, especially in the very, very beginning. We have always raised more money than we thought we needed. There's a famous, I think it's Tom Perkins quote, the time to raise money is when people are giving it to you. And as a guy who lived through the market closure of post-Lehman and the post-2001, I've got those scars. So we've always tried to raise more money than we needed. It was easier at every step, but no different because you answer all the questions. Again, if you're the first of your kind, right, you answer all the questions. People say, oh, I need you to do X and Y and Z. And you're like, great, I've cleared all those inflection points. They're like, yeah, but now you have these ahead of you. You got to be committed to what you're going to do.
You both work with a co-founder. You mentioned meeting Steph and working with her on the idea in the early days. Was it obvious to you from the beginning that you were going to do this together?
I actually think we were at a really interesting time in our lives because we didn't have that light bulb moment of let's quit our jobs and do this. I had just left my job in London. I had didn't have a visa, so I had to move back to New York. She was still in business school. So we were both kind of like interviewing. You know, I actually think that had we not had the conversations when we did, like the timing really worked out that I'd be, you know, a CMO of some fashion company somewhere and she'd be a COO at a different product company. And I think because we had slightly too much time on our hands, that when we were digging into it and we were doing a little bit of research, and because we weren't working at the time, we could do things like, hey, let's just go to this travel goods trade show in Vegas for a few days. We could do things like that. And we joke that to this day, we still haven't really had the conversation of sitting down and saying, hey, let's start this company together. Obviously, a bunch of paperwork and stuff had to happen. So we kind of both were in the right place at the right time and had the right idea.
How about you? Have you found it easy to work with?
So I have two co-founders.
Yeah.
And then we had a CTO who joined as employee four, who's super important. I grew up playing team sports, both literally and metaphorically in business. This business in particular doesn't work unless you have a team. We pride ourselves on the kind of ability to work with real cognitive diversity. Biologists think very differently about the world than computer scientists do, and both think differently about the world than business people. And we only work if you've got all of those people working together. So I think actually for me, the co-founding aspect, the team aspect, has been one of the great joys of it. We were a slightly older startup. Everybody had some experience before, kind of real wins and losses, to be honest. And so that's allowed us, I think, in really nice ways. One of the things I'm proudest of is the way we've all navigated the kind of growth of the business and the fact that you go, in the beginning, we didn't even have titles, right? You're kind of partners, right? And at a certain point in a 500-person company, like there are roles. Right. And so we're very good and quite intentional about saying, okay, now I'm talking to you as my co-founder. Now I'm talking to you as your boss. Now I'm talking to you and we are both members of the board. Right. And just to be very explicit about that. And I think people have done a great job and it's been really a joy.
Jen, there's a big conversation about lack of diversity in business. And there was a study that showed less than 2% of the money last year, VC money went to women-owned and women-started firms. Did you feel that when you were pitching? Was it a factor, or was that something that you thought about when you were going out pitching?
Did it happen? Probably. If I think about it, probably that guy who was setting up his Apple Watch when we were pitching him maybe was not taking us that seriously.
He was doing the same thing to me.
That might just have been him.
Certainly, I'm sure it happened. I think gender bias is a lot more subtle than people think it is. And a lot of times people don't even understand that the way they're perceiving how someone is listening or speaking or whatever is part of that. But did we feel like it stopped us? I think part of it is that we were either too naive or too confident to really notice it. But also, you know, we're problem solvers. We set out to raise a certain amount of capital. We got the capital from the partners that we wanted it from. Were there no's along the way? Sure. With hindsight, everything is 2020. But all women founding teams, like you said, raise about 2% of venture capital. They don't make 2% of revenue. So there's a huge gap there. And I think what Steph and I think about all the time is now we are in the position to support women and hire women and mentor them and invest in them and also educate them, just because we kind of got through this process without feeling like we were really subject to a lot of bias doesn't mean that there are not hundreds or thousands of women out there dealing with that. So we are definitely taking a lot of time to be role models and mentors to the next generation of women who are coming up through the ranks and maybe don't know how to speak to investors the way we knew how to in the early days.
So Dan, you've worked around this industry for a long time, worked with a lot of successful women entrepreneurs. What are the obstacles? What do we need to do to encourage more women to start their businesses and encourage more equitable funding in the space?
Yeah, you're right. I have, over the course of a 26-year career, I've worked with some extraordinary women in a number of great CEOs, CFOs, chair people, but the numbers are the numbers, and we have to change that and change that gap or narrow that gap, eliminate that gap. And I think Jen gets at it, the two big issues. One is access to capital, and the other is access to kind of a mentor network and a community of people that you can turn to ask questions and get advice and everything else that we all take for granted. And people in general take for granted. It's an important part of being a entrepreneur and building your business and making decisions and the like. And so our effort at Goldman, the launch at GS that we're doing, we're raising $500 million of our own capital and client capital to invest in women-led companies, women-founded companies, women-led investment managers to eliminate the bias gap and to get more money into the hands of these people who have great ideas and can be great at executing but need the capital.
Josh, you are in a field that doesn't always have a lot of representation of women like a lot of other industries. What have you done around hiring to more diversity in your workforce?
In the life sciences, it is a more diverse field. There's a fair number of female. We don't have an issue there. We did make a big effort to recruit female software engineers and machine learning folks. What became great was once you do that, the whole thing becomes a lot easier. Because talented female engineer who went to MIT and is working at Microsoft shows up and half of her interview panel are women, and suddenly like a whole bunch of questions she has get answered without ever having been asked. What do we do in the beginning? We redesign the interview process to do things like getting rid of whiteboard coding interviews. So that's where you kind of come in and you give them a problem and somebody's got a kind of whiteboard. And there's a bunch of evidence that it rewards traits that are associated with gender. And for sure, we found that it had nothing to do with success. We had one of the guys who did the best job on it was an early engineer. He was actually the first person we let go of the company. He was an unbelievably smart guy, but he was just a terrible engineer. He wasn't a team guy. Every commitment he wanted to do had to refactor the code base. He was a disaster.
But he was good at the whiteboard.
He was great at the whiteboard. And so once we started doing this, once we started testing for things like, can you work collaboratively? Can you go through code review? Can you present to a group of people? Can you engage with folks? Then by doing that and overweighting slightly our recruiting pipeline, I won't say it solved itself. I think that the truth of the matter is that the kind of the institutional weight is not biased towards gender normality or gender equality, and so you have to fight it at every step. But the more you fight, the easier it gets.
So we'll wrap up. This has been a fascinating discussion with a couple quick questions. Dan, you've been working around entrepreneurs your whole life. Have you ever had the itch? What's kept you at Goldman?
I think you have to know what you're good at. I knew I was a pretty good banker. Honestly, I don't know that I had the courage to be an entrepreneur early in my career. I didn't have that risk appetite and the sacrifices they make and the risks they take. I don't think I had it. The other thing I'd say, though, is something that keeps me at Goldman and keeps me excited about Goldman. While I never was an entrepreneur, I've had a front row seat with Jack Ma and Jack Dorsey and Elon Musk and Evan Spiegel and on and on. I get to be someone who works with them and advises them around important points in their growth of their companies, and you get to do it with a number of companies. I've enjoyed that seat as opposed to jumping into one particular car and driving.
Jen, what's been your proudest moment as a founder?
Well, it happens every time in the airport, which is too much. but yeah, we started out just seeing one away bag every time I was at the airport. And now there are dozens, and sometimes there are entire flights of them. So I think just...
Do you snap pictures?
I used to. It got really weird, though. People were like, what are you
Someone's
doing?
Stalking me and taking a picture of my luggage.
And I also go to the airport way too late to do that now. but yeah, just seeing the product out in the wild, seeing people use them, and when I chat with them, when I'm feeling up to it, just hearing their feedback about how it is improving their travel experience.
So Josh, what were the reactions from your friends and family when you just told them you were quitting your job and starting a new company?
Especially living in San Francisco, I don't think folks had a reaction to that. I think folks didn't understand and still kind of don't, what exactly does we do? I had a friend who said, oh yeah, you're starting a science company, right? And he couldn't be any more descriptive than that.
What's the best advice both of you have gotten about starting a business?
For me, I think it really is two things. I think it's raise more money than you think you're going to need and make sure you're committed to the mission of what you're doing. Whether it's written down, I mean, I know philosophy is very about that, but like be doing it for something more than just a business.
How about you, Jen?
You know, I think it really just is about the people and the team. Had someone actually warned me in the beginning that I'd basically be a full-time HR person as a founder, I might not have done it, but I think all of the big learnings I've had around the business just really went back to the team that we're building and how they're able to execute on our vision.
Dan, you've been out here for a couple of days. You've seen and heard a lot of entrepreneurs. What's getting you most excited?
Spending a couple of days around this group of dynamic entrepreneurs who are out pursuing their passions, building these businesses, you can't help but come away from these 48 hours massively optimistic and energized. And that, to me, that's what I love about this conference every year is you come away from it with so much optimism, so much energy, and that's what I'm most excited about.
Great. Well, I'll second that. That's all for this episode of Exchanges Goldman Sachs. Thank you all for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed listening, and be sure to join us again next time.
This podcast was recorded on October 18th, 2018. The information contained in this recording was obtained from publicly available sources and has not been independently verified by Goldman Sachs. Neither Goldman Sachs nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed. This recording should not be relied upon to evaluate any potential transaction. Goldman Sachs is not giving investment advice by means of this recording, and this recording does not establish a client relationship with Goldman Sachs.